Hey listeners, Chloe here. If you need to stay as up to date with the latest developments and innovations in the luxury industry as I do, you need to dive into Vogue Business. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty, delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Just visit VogueBusiness.com today and use the code RUN20 at checkout to join the Vogue Business community. That's VogueBusiness.com, promo code RUN20. Don't miss out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I know how hard it is to find the perfect gift for Mother's Day. My mom is one of those people who seems to have everything. But still, I want to find her something that makes her day special. Macy's Mother's Day gift guide has you covered with the perfect gifts to make mom feel special. Shop at Macy's.com/gift finder for the best gifts for your Mother's Day.
Welcome to the Run Through with Vogue. I'm Chloe Mal.
And I'm Cho Minardi. And this week on the show, we have one of our good friends
and colleague.
Welcome, Taylor.
Yeah, hi. Hi, guys.
Taylor Antrim.
Yes.
Executive editor of Vogue.
No, God, start over.
Taylor Antrim, deputy editor of Vogue.
There you go. There you go. That's me. Hello,
and chief film critic at Vogue.
Ooh, I love
yes,
it.
Yes,
I love
yes,
it.
Yes.
Has joined us to discuss. Yeah, unofficially, officially. Has yeah. joined us to discuss the hottest award season contenders.
Yeah.
I have great curiosity about Choma's best right. dressed from the Golden Globes.
Well, I felt like the clothes were not the main event, but there was a lot of discussion in the group Slack channel and also on Twitter, apparently, the fact that none of the presenters asked credits. Did you notice that?
At the beginning? You mean in the interviews?
Usually the first thing that they do is they say, what are you wearing? Tell us what you're wearing.
But that's been years that they haven't been allowed to do that.
No, they've done that.
No. There's been a whole campaign over the past 4 years to not ask women first what they're wearing particularly.
But they did at some point address it.
But I thought that Laverne Cox asked...
I miss Laverne. Sorry.
I was watching Laverne and she was saying to people, tell me about the story you're telling with your outfit, which I thought was a hilarious way to sidestep that. You're right. They definitely don't ask anymore.
They don't ask anymore.
Like it used to be the first question you got all your credits.
Still, I just think...
I know. I agree.
Why completely... I get it. We're more than the sum of our dress, but...
We're more than the sum of our Cartier.
Yeah. But you want to know. I want to know. And I think it kind of annoyed me. Anyway, I don't know when this rule was eliminated or made.
It's been a gradual shift.
It's been a gradual shift. Okay. First, I'd like to call out Emma Darcy. They looked incredible in Acne.
Yeah.
They were one of the few people.
They are an actor from House of Dragons. Game of Thrones spin-off.
House of the Dragons.
House of Dragons is a board game.
I mean, if it's going to win a Golden Globe, you got to like name it properly.
And on screen, they're a blonde, but in real life, they were a brunette.
Yeah, they were wearing
oversized suit, which a tuxedo. And it was really fun. It was an Acne... So a younger brand not going with the kind of, you know,
but
a little
also
bit sort
they
of
had like a very intense blue eyeliner and like one
and a glittery shoe.
One tear coming down, and I couldn't
this I
tell
missed.
If they did that on purpose, like a Johnny Depp crybaby thing, or if they just teared up because they were also very emotional about being there.
Right. And then got trashed with their co-star on stage.
Oh, yeah. She had fun.
But we'll save that for later.
Yeah we got to get to the drunk celebs later.
And who else did
truly
I love?
Truly the raison d'etre for the whole
Golden
operation.
Globes. Yes.
Golden Globes. Yeah. Seriously, that was the whole point. But I thought Daisy Edgar Jones looked good in Gucci. There were a lot of people in Gucci. She needed to dial it up with the glam. I thought Michelle Yeoh looked really good.
Yeah, in her Armani sort of beaded sequin peplum.
Yeah, she looked chic.
And long hair. There was a lot of
and obviously Rihanna.
Good hair
Rihanna,
moments.
Who
oh,
did
yes,
not
yes.
show up on the carpet in Schiaparelli. Her hair was incredible.
It reminded me of George Costanza when he says that he his dream in life is to be
swaddled in velvet.
Yes.
Just be draped in velvet.
Yeah, and usually I'm not here for black on the red carpet, but I thought she looked fabulous.
No, she did. There were some good velvet moments. Selena Gomez and Valentino had sort of...
Not my favorite.
Okay, okay.
Not my favorite.
All right.
The silhouette wasn't quite gelling for me, but love Selena and the high ponytail on the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Here for that.
I was very happy with a lot of suiting moments. I thought
the men really showed up and did
Eddie
did
Redmayne
well.
And his chocolate brown with that floppy silk rosette.
He always likes to try something different.
Yeah, I want to hear you on the suit changes Gerard Carmichael went through over the course of the evening.
Six outfit changes.
It was wild.
I honestly felt that maybe his wardrobe redeemed his hosting abilities.
Oh, we should talk about his hosting abilities. I mean, I thought his speech was amazing.
The opening speech was great, but then it sort of peered off.
And Joma and I have been talking about wondering how much he was paid, so now we know.
I know.
Do we believe that figure, though?
Yeah, he can't say that and not be true, no?
He's also a comedian. He can say whatever he likes.
Yeah.
Is that true? Okay, maybe. I believe it.
But I did think it was a very subversive speech. And Ricky Gervais used to get up there and trash everybody in the audience, and that was part of the charge of watching the Golden Globes. You had this, like, dangerous opening monologue, you know? And I thought the genius thing about Gerard was that he, like, honored that tradition, but it felt very up to date. It felt like a generational shift on how to unsettle an audience and be really authentic. And I thought it was great. The question was, like, do we need the Golden Globes anymore? And I thought, after watching that, I was like, yes,
yeah,
we should have the Golden Globes every
year. I agree.
Year.
Hand raising my hand.
Yes. I like it because it's the only one with TV and film. And I feel like it's really nice to have both categories together, especially now that it's so overlapping with streaming.
Yeah. Agree. And, you know, if you don't
have... What do they call it? Prestige TV? Yeah. Prestige TV.
Yeah.
Millennial in the mix.
And if you don't have TV, you don't have, like, Mike White and Jennifer Coolidge, like, acting out their platonic love affair on the stage.
One of my favorite moments.
That really was charming. And Mike White, like, legitimately drunk on stage, which is the thing you want to see when you tune into the Golden Globes, right? I mean, I don't know if
he was glassy-eyed. It was so obvious.
He said he was going to give his acceptance speech in Italian, but he was too drunk to pull it off.
That's hilarious.
I mean,
I love him.
Love him, right? And Jennifer Coolidge was great. I mean, she got two speeches out of Jennifer Coolidge, and the second one was better than the first one.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Golden Globes don't take themselves as seriously as the Oscars, and that's what you want out of the Golden Globes. So you have kind of a wacky, weird, slightly unexpected, you know, award show, and I feel like we got some elements of that. I mean, there are 10 movies that are going to get Academy Award nominations, and from
all right, tell us.
All
what's
I'm
it
going to
be?
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure I can reel them all off, but I'm
well,
not
hello,
sure.
Hello, Taylor. What are you here for?
Between
well,
us,
Well, I
can.
Think on the bubble, if we want to talk about what's on the bubble, like, these really good movies are on the bubble. Women King, Women Talking, White Noise. I think more...
Women King is Viola Davis?
I've seen it.
Okay.
I've seen that one.
I haven't.
That made a lot of money. Yeah. It made like $300 million.
So why does that make money and Fablemans doesn't?
So this is the question, right?
Okay.
Movies are going through a crisis because you had a year in which two movies made over $3 billion combined. Those movies are Avatar Way of Water and Top Gun Maverick.
James Cameron is saying it's on the red carpet, go to the movies. I need you at the movies. Why is he complaining?
Because Tar makes like $8 million.
Okay.
You know, Fablemans makes like $15 million. She said, do you know anyone who's seen that movie? That's a really good movie.
Artie's preschool teacher, Jill, loved it.
I loved it too. I thought it was great.
You should know a rhetorical question when you hear one. so like, you know, the problem is streaming is not going to support making movies like that. Netflix spent $100 million on White Noise, but they're not going to keep doing that, you know? And like, who's going to pony up the money for a movie like Tar if it's only going to make $8 million in the box office? So my grand theory of the case is that award season is coming along and has to weigh in on this question of whether movies like art or commerce, you know, are movies all going to be, you know, big spectacles at the box office shooting for $1.5 billion, you know, which they may get or they may not. Or are they going to be try to be like real interesting, creative, artistic statements? I mean, I love Tar. I love Banshees of Inisherin. Like, this was a pretty good year for art house movies, but no one went to see them. And if you're relying on streaming for these movies to get an audience, like, there just isn't the like business model there to support it. And I think that the drama around the Academy Awards is what side are they going to weigh in on? Are they going to give Best Picture to a movie like Top Gun or Avatar? And that's always been a tension. I remember back in 2019, Black Panther was nominated for Best Picture, and everybody was like, is this the year that Marvel, which is, you know, the kind of movie that people really flock to the movie theaters to see, is this the year that Marvel is going to get, like, Best Picture? And it didn't. I don't remember what won that year, to be honest. But you know, it's always been a tension, and I feel like the stakes are just sky high on that question this year because the box office, you know, it's so variable. It's either like nothing, it's feast or famine, you know.
Where did the audience go for art house movies? Why did they just suddenly disappear?
Like, because during COVID, they got them all served to them streaming services.
Right.
And once you've had a taste of that.
I am guilty of that.
Yeah. I mean, my theory is once you get out of the practice of going to a movie theater to see a serious movie like Tar, you don't go back to that. It's almost like muscle memory, you know?
Right.
And
so you just go to see the big blockbusters? I mean, that's what I do.
Exactly. Exactly. And that it's sort of like the IMAXification of movies.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to go see something that's just going to like blow my face off, you know? And I don't know. I mean, I went to see Tar in a theater.
You did? That's
cute.
Can you see it online yet?
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen Tar?
I haven't either.
Come on,
guilty,
Chloe.
Guilty. We have a few weeks to do it.
Small children is 3 hours.
I mean, two small children. Anyway, what I'm saying is—
Your children sleep through the night.
What I'm saying is I saw Tar on a big screen, and I staggered out of that theater. I mean, if you talk about going to a movie theater and having, like, a real experience, like, Tar works you, you know? It's too long, I think, but it's really, like— I mean, I don't know. I go see some of these big sort of spectacle blockbuster movies and I get bored. Like it kind of washes over you. Like,
I wish I'd seen Top Gun in theater.
I saw Avatar in the theater and I definitely staggered out for a different reason.
Thumbs up or thumbs down on Avatar?
I mean, it just kind of washes over you. And sometimes like you just kind of like need that.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's too long.
So this is what I don't want. I mean, I love movies and I love going to movies.
I think there's room for both. I like to do both.
I hope so. Anyway, the Golden Globes landing on Fablemans was like a vote in like, we need serious movies still in movie theaters. Let's go. Let's encourage people that this is the movie they got to see. My question is, will the Oscars do the same? Will they be like, nope, you know what? The people spoke, and Avatar is best picture of the year. And that's it. I know, but it could happen. It could happen.
You think?
I haven't checked, but like $1.7 billion? Like, that's just insane.
Wow.
Insane.
And it's 3 hours, 12 minutes, guys. It's a commitment.
And you know what the Oscars used to do is it used to pick like kind of a middle ground, like a populist art house movie. Like a
Shakespeare in Love.
Yes. Or like a Coda. Remember that?
Yeah.
You know?
Remember that. It was like a year ago.
was that last year? It was last year.
Yeah. Remember way back when Coda was in?
Yeah, and a streaming movie. You know, that was on Apple TV Plus. That wasn't even in a movie theater. So, like, they used to choose this middle ground of finding, like, or Green Book. Remember that?
Yeah.
You know, they would find, like a movie that was popular but still kind of in this prestige zone. And I wonder if this is the year that breaks.
No, we have to talk about Florence Pugh's cover.
Yeah.
I just read the story. Chloe Sharma, our culture editor, wrote it. It's great.
Yeah,
they spent
really
a really fun multi-activity day together. And Florence just seems like someone you would love to spend a day with. She starts by making everyone martinis and then it just goes from there.
I'd love to get drunk with her. Yeah.
Yeah. She was super fun.
She's delightful. I mean, just like what a star. We're lucky to have her.
What are her big movies coming out? Why are we focusing on her?
She has a film coming out. It's written and directed by her ex, Zach Braff, called A Good Person, which is coming out in March. It's sort of an indie movie.
Okay.
But she's also in Dune Part 2, which is coming out this year, and Oppenheimer, which is...
What's Oppenheimer?
So yeah. Oppenheimer is the big Christopher Nolan movie that's coming out this year.
Oh.
And so she has two, like, really big budget, big swings, like, box office plays that are coming. But this indie movie was the peg for the cover story.
Chetma, what else are you thinking about this week?
I was very sad to hear about the news about Tatiana Patitz.
I know. I was really sad. She was one of the iconic Big Five supermodels
you interviewed
of the
her.
90s. I interviewed her 10 years ago. It was a piece on models at home with their families. She was a single mom to her then 8-year-old son, Jonah. She had moved to an amazing ranch in Santa Ynez, California, and it was just this very picturesque and storybook life of her son would bike to his Montessori school and then she would ride her horses and take care of the animals all day. And she was just very much a sort of mother of the earth, kind of eschewed the high glamour lifestyle. We got the news, Vogue.com broke the news that she passed away at 56.
So sad. I mean, because I think she was one of the lesser known supermodels.
Yeah.
Which photographers would
well,
you she say
was
she worked
famously,
with?
Famously, she was in the Peter Lindbergh shoot in Dumbo. sort of with the Brooklyn Bridge behind her. She was in the George Michael Freedom music video. I'm
pretty sure she was, yeah.
We're very sad about that. Yeah. I was sort of impressed that Louis Vuitton and Yayoi Kusama could manage to pull off another collaboration that had everyone talking. And
I know.
About.
I think it was, I mean, really kudos to them for completely reinventing the launch of a collab. I mean, she
Taylor, have you seen this? It's polka dots, just painted polka dots all
over.
Yeah,
the entire sort of Louis Vuitton.
Well, I took my son already today on our way to school to see the store. And there's a robot of Kusama in the window that is so lifelike, it is eerie.
Yeah.
Her cheeks move, like her buccal fat is rippling. It's wild. Her eyes are flap. It was, we had to leave. It was weird. But yeah, I mean, who would have thought that this, you know, sticking dots on a bag again, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm sold. It's a knit bag
over.
For a reason.
Yeah. I mean, Louis Vuitton had other big news this week, too. Kid Super, who was part of the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund.
I've never heard of this person.
Well, what? He's a name to watch.
Okay,
so,
but is he a designer? Is he...
He's a designer. Okay. He's a New York-based designer, Brooklyn-based designer. He has really fantastic ideas, and he's known for his kind of out-of-the-box shows and concepts.
Does he have a real name?
Something like Column.
Okay. Is he replacing Virgil?
No, he's doing a guest... He's doing a guest collection. Obviously, that's big shoes to fill, so I think it's kind of wise that they went this route, but... You know, great that they gave it to an American designer, young and kind of like maverick in the same way that I think Virgil was very kind of, you know, he just always thought outside of the box.
Okay.
So it'll be interesting to see what he does with the...
Is it just for men?
Just for men.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Who is reading Spare?
Oh, definitely not.
No, but I've heard it's really fun read.
I'm listening to it. I'm 2 hours in. I almost missed my subway stop hearing about he's getting into Camilla. I'm totally there for
it. Is it good?
Ish. It's good-ish. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big J.R. Moeringer fan. I think he's like a great ghostwriter. He did Andre Agassi and Phil Knight's Shoe Dog. And I think it's good. I am very excited to hear about his frostbitten penis. I feel like that's, like, the most...
I can't believe you said that.
I have not actually heard about this. Tell us more.
Wait, you're not heard about what is wrong with you?
Listen, I read the aggregated, like, I'm not going to actually read Spare. So, of course, I do read the, like, 11 takeaways.
This is everywhere.
And
this is everywhere.
He said on Colbert on Tuesday, he said, my frost nip on it, my todger.
Well, okay. One more time, Chloe Mall, please.
Frost nip on his todger.
can we get that embroidered on a t-shirt?
Well, actually, speaking of embroidery, he said that the last time he went to a cold climate, a lady friend got him a cock cushion to protect his todger, and this time he didn't have that, and that's why it got nipped. And actually, I've had a similar situation with my dog Lloyd. When it's really cold, he's gotten like ice stuck on his fur on his penis, and I've just had to like wipe it off with a warm washcloth.
Chloe, stop right there.
My question is, did the Daily Mail translate that passage from the original Spanish? I mean, it was a crazy media moment. It was like the Daily Mail has their hands on the Spanish edition of Spare. It was
apparently it's a big upset because the Guardian got the English, so they had a huge time leg up.
Imagine the rivalry between the Guardian and the Daily Mail.
Can you believe that it's already, and Susie Menk has put on Instagram that it's already half price at the airport?
No.
Oh, I hear it's selling
off.
Gangbusters.
Of course it is.
Why would they put it 50% off? Explain that to me.
Well, I don't know, but...
Oh, I think that's just how they sell books at the airport.
That's not possible. But I did see a picture of a window of a bookstore in Piccadilly that had it in the window display as Spare next to another book called How to Kill Your Family.
Oh, perfect.
And they just had all of those
that.
There. And so we know what the UK general feeling
British
is.
British humor. We love it.
Yeah.
Actually, a friend sent me kind of a picture of the newsstand the day after. And it was just like a wall of Harry content.
Yeah, of
course.
Was
just complete takeover.
I want to know per capita if the book is selling better in the UK or the US. Like, I think that the, you know, there's more of an audience for this book, frankly, in the US.
You think still?
Yeah.
I don't think that's true. I think it's equal. Or I don't know. I don't think every bookstore in the US has it plastered across the whole wall of the bookstore.
Chloe, need I point out that we have an English person here and an American person here, and only the American person is listening to Spare. Not reading.
Busy, okay? Taylor, officially the deputy editor of Vogue, what a treat.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? Maybe a chef-grade range made you want to hone your cooking skills, or a high-tech tennis racket made you want to work on your backhand. I recently bought a new pair of running shoes, and that made me love hitting the pavement again. Well, when we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Choma, Jesse Buckley is one of my favorite actors of the moment. She's also sort of, I feel like, this stealth darling of Vogue and has been for a while. Don't you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. We're all fangirls for Jesse.
Yeah. I first fell in love with her in the movie Wild Rose, where she plays this Scottish ex-con trying to make it big on the Nashville country music scene. And then there was obviously last year's The Lost Daughter was her big, I feel like, U.S. film
that's
breakthrough.
That's when I really discovered her, to be honest. I'm a late
Buckley bloomer.
I'm a late Buckley bloomer.
Maggie Gyllenhaal's directorial debut, The Lost Daughter, it was this very raw, frank film about maternal ambivalence. And Jesse Buckley plays this young mother grappling with very tough choices. And she got an Oscar nomination for it. And she's just so good in it. And there's something so crackling and delectable about all of her performances.
I mean, that movie, The Lost Daughter, is one of my favorites of
really?
Last year.
Mm-hmm. Well, now she's getting all sorts of attention again for Sarah Polley's film, Women Talking. It's also a very intense film. It's about rape in a Mennonite community. Jesse plays Marika, a Mennonite woman in an abusive relationship who is brimming with fire and rage, rightly so, but it makes for a very powerful performance.
Yeah, I mean, the film is, you know, it's serious. It's super intense. But what I love about her is that she brings this irreverence to the way she dresses, and I find that really appealing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she walked in with that wonderful outfit in this kind of very avant-garde, punky leather ensemble that had these, you know, big ballooning sleeves and a vest that was, or kind of a sheath that was leather, and then leather trousers. So she has fun with it. And when we met her this week, we jumped right into talking about how she's always experimenting with her hair.
She always has a great blunt chop.
She really does. Hair is always.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, you're always experimenting with different colors and.
Yeah, I kind of, to be honest, like I find hair quite hard work. I'd like to shave it off. I just watched that Sinead O'Connor documentary. Have you seen
it? I've heard it's so good. I'm dying to watch it.
She's just the coolest. Yeah. And when I was growing up in Ireland, like, we were told that she was like, you know, be careful of her, you know. But actually, she was so ahead of her time.
Yeah.
Shave her. She's just so beautiful and cool. Yeah. And so anyway, maybe I'll shave my hair off soon.
You have a face that you can carry. I've always liked the idea of it, but I just feel like too naked.
It's tough.
I need hair to just distract from everything else.
Oh, we are beautiful. Apparently, we could all do it. We could be like Vivian Westwood, which is very sad.
Oh, I know. I thought, we were talking about her last week.
She was a real moment for Choma.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just think that...
Have you ever worn any of her clothes?
Yeah. I wore something of hers recently and to the London Film Festival.
Was it the stripes?
Yeah. It was like a corset,
amazing
Harlequin dress, and I loved it. And actually, it was like such, because I came in and I was like, I'm just going to have so much fun this year. Like, and especially with women talking, and because Marieke is quite like hard work, I was like, I'm just going to be the opposite. I'm just going to like
that's such a good
color and fun. And I love, and like every time we get to meet up with all the, you know, girls on the red carpet, we all just kind of laugh.
Do you coordinate?
I don't know. A few times we've been like, we're all wearing black. And then, and then the black doesn't look very nice. And I'm like in some kind of clown Harlequin colorful dress.
I feel like that would be uncomfortable if you and Claire showed up at an awards show both in like fuchsia.
Maybe we should try it and see.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have a long like award season sort of marathon?
I've no idea. Last year when I with Oscar and BAFTA, I was doing Cabaret in the West End, so I missed it all.
Whoa, right.
So this is my first kind of, I guess, time kind of going around with it. And
well, like, did you get to come for the Oscars last year?
Oh, yeah. I just came for the Oscars and I came with my boyfriend. Wow. And we were like, let's just have a party. Oh, we were with Olivia Colman and her husband, Ed, and we're all quite close. So we actually ended up making friends with the guy in the lift of the Oscars. We missed the moment because we made friends with the guy in the lift.
Wait, what moment did you miss?
The Will Smith moment.
Oh my god. Of course.
I would have wanted
to be there.
Well, we made friends with the guy in the lift, and our task for the night was to give him margaritas. So we kept requesting this one guy in the lift, and we were like,
lift is elevator, everyone.
Sorry.
Choma's our translator.
I'm sorry. I've had to do this so many years.
He wasn't an Uber.
So when we came back into the room, everyone was like, can you believe it? We're like, what? Do you know that we've been giving this guy margaritas in the elevator? And also we went to Madonna's after party, and me and my boyfriend were like, this is really crazy. And then
who did you chat with at the after party?
We were with Ed and Olivia, so we kind of had our little corner. And at one point, we'd all went dancing, and we were like having a great time. And then it was about 1 a.m., and I was like, I really just want a plate of pasta. So I like went in, and I got a plate of pasta, and I plonked myself down on a step, and I had a beer. And then one of Olivia's makeup artists, she was like, thank God you're eating pasta. And she like it went in and she got a plate of pasta, and the two of us just like had a chat about life and like where we were going on holidays. And but also we were like, oh my God, it's Leonardo DiCaprio's behind us.
What are you excited to wear this award season? Is there like one, like you're just going to go totally anti-Marieke?
No, not anti. I love her. I feel very protective of her.
I did notice in the movie that it's like there's a designer that Choma and I love, Batsheva, and
it's oh, like
sort
whole,
of Mennonite yeah. clothes.
I love Batsheva.
And the whole good, time yes. I was watching, I was like, we this love whole movie too. Is a...
Actually, when I turned 30, I bought like a Batsheva white dress.
Did you?
And it's like my birthday dress. And if I ever get married, I've decided I'm going to wear it, and I'm going to get everybody to, I think she did it in like one of her shows where she sent it around and got everybody to write messages of love on like this white dress.
So anyway,
that's what I'm going to do. Maybe socks and sandals, you know, keep it real.
I love it. It sounds like you're really into fashion. It's not something that you had to back into as in your job?
I don't know. I'm getting to know it more. And
well, she's wearing a really great outfit right now. If you can describe it, please, and give us the credit. Yeah,
tell us about this.
I think it's like a kind of 1920s Joan of Arc.
Yeah, good description. God, you need to be writing. You need to be writing fashion reviews for us.
It's Miyake, I think.
It's cool. Yeah. I love it.
I have people that I really enjoyed wearing, like Schiaparelli and Erdem, and with fashion and clothes, I feel like I've felt like I've wanted to wear different things at different points in my life, depending on where I am myself, and kind of finding the confidence to own that, whatever that is. And sometimes you get it completely wrong and sometimes you get it right. But I guess you learn every time you do it. And it's such an art, looking at, you know, Schiaparelli.
It's like
surrealism. And I love all that stuff. Like when you see a narrative behind something and you might be able to create something with that and then have a kind of character with it, is fun.
They say that you wear 20% of your clothes 80% of the time.
Yeah.
What's your like number one thing that you're wearing over and over right now?
Tracksuit pants.
From who?
I have no idea. Like American Vintage or something like that. Like I think the only time I've ever met Anna was after Cabaret. And I was like, usually after Cabaret in London, I would just hop on my bike and cycle home as quickly as possible to like, and I came out in like tracksuit pants and a like oversized t-shirt and trainers. I was like, hi, I'm gonna go on my bike where I belong.
I know. I know that you sometimes will find photos or paintings that you love and make t-shirts into them.
Oh yeah. I love doing that.
What's the last t-shirt you made?
I've got a picture of Lee Miller in Hitler's bath.
And oh my gosh. Incredible.
And printed it. And she looks so amazing, and printed that on her. And then when I was doing Cabaret, there's this amazing performance artist called Valeska Gert, who is this like punk in the 1920s. And she would do these like radical things and like stand up in front of a cinema, and her protest would be silence. And she would just do this weird little dance. And I have a picture of her kind of doing this weird dance on a t-shirt.
Wow.
But
wow.
I love making it. It's great. I love, yeah.
Is there like one website you use?
Yeah. I'm not selling them. Like, these are one-off JB t-shirts.
Like a Supreme drop.
Yeah.
Good initials for a fashion line. JB.
Yeah. JB exclusive. I loved watching Jesse and Women Talking. I actually watched it with my family on Christmas night, which was heavy, but it's based on a novel by Miriam Toews, which is inspired by a true story of over 100 women that were raped in a Mennonite community in Bolivia in 2011. And much of the film takes place almost like a play in this one room, which is a hayloft, where a quorum of the women in this community come together to debate their options. Do they stay and fight their abusers or pack up and leave the only life they've ever known? I mean, honestly, we should have watched Elf, but I'm kidding. But despite being a heavy subject matter, there's a light touch to the way Sarah Pauley has directed it and the way that these women come together to do these performances that makes it very watchable.
Yeah, I mean, you watched it before me and told me about the film, and I felt that, you know, maybe I was walking into something a little heavy for a beginning of the year. But it was actually, it's been amazing to watch the cast as they do press for the film too. You know, felt like they really bonded. And not just Jesse Buckley, but Rooney Mara, Claire Foy, Ben Whishaw, Frances McDormand.
It's not a cast of wallflowers. I mean, this is a power-packed cast.
Yeah, and they seem to all have fun with each other too. It seemed like they became a family.
They're all just the most extraordinary people and actors. And Sarah Pauley, the director, who's just the most extraordinary woman, she just created an environment where we are all able to take a risk and not just act, but genuinely experience in real time and change each other's minds in real time.
Wow.
And she did that by creating a place of utmost trust and support. And she had like an on-set therapist there. And
I couldn't believe that. I've never heard of that before. And
how did it work?
A great idea.
Yeah, how does that work?
Well, I guess, you know, the material is quite intense. And we had young actresses that had never worked before, and we had crew members who'd, you know, been affected by some of the themes in the film before. And, you know, it seems like a pretty practical thing to do, actually, and quite a, like, important, caring thing to do. And Dee Dee Gardner, who's, like, our trailblazing producer, said, you know, we'll put it in the budget. We're going to make it work. That's.
And did you make use of a therapist?
I did. Being, like, honest, initially I was like, you can stand far away from me. Do not come anywhere. I know exactly, you know. And then there was a moment, like, right at the end, and I'm not somebody who takes it home. Like, I'm like, you know, when you come back from the hayloft, we all would kind of go into the green room and we talk about what we're going to have for dinner and, you know, where we want to, you know, just like normal things. And there was such a respect to know that actually what we had to do in the hayloft was intense and important, and actually we needed to come back and chill out. But at one point at the end, I kind of didn't really realize that actually Marieke was just, she was just like quite full on to kind of carry around. And it was like a kind of point of, I think there was a point where we were about to leave, you know, make the decision to leave. And I just kind of spun out a bit and had a big old cry and called her, and she was great. And she's such an extraordinary woman. Her name's Dr. Laurie Haskell. And she's just been given the Order of Canada for her work that she's been doing for trauma and, you know, domestic abuse survivors. And she was so useful in lots of ways, you know, to kind of talk to her about that.
And that's so smart of Sarah and Dee Dee to do that.
I've learned so much from Sarah, but like as a leader, to have somebody who leads from such a kind of powerful vulnerability and who has such intense curiosity about everybody on set, you know, she would not only, you know, ask us as actors what we felt about a scene, but she involved the whole crew and everybody's point of view was valid. And I think that was what was interesting about this experience, was she was able to contain these heightened perspectives and have a real-time genuine debate and allow each other to affect each other from these kind of points of view, so that we could all kind of move forward and kind of remove layers of skin and unlearn things so that we could collectively learn something new and have courage to move somewhere new that we didn't really, you know, it wasn't like they were kind of going off into the sunset to some utopia. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It takes huge bravery to do what these women are doing and to find a new language for themselves with that bravery as well. And having, you know, Sarah, Fran and Dee Dee being the leaders of that helm, it definitely was helped and so empowering. And
Frances McDormand, who's a producer and in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. What would you guys do in the evening? I remember you and I spoke on the phone briefly last year about The Lost Daughter. I was doing a piece on Maggie and I loved hearing about how much fun you guys were having afterward. You said you were singing and you and Olivia were drinking rosé into the wee hours. Was there anything like that on this set? It feels like a different vibe maybe, but...
Yes, there was, yes. yeah, we did, you know, we kind of have nights where we'd all come over to mine and I'd order loads of pizzas and we'd go and have margaritas and go and kind of...
Was there sing-alongs again?
No sing-alongs this time. No, there wasn't kind of a that air of singing.
And I love that you said that it's usually the quiet ones who are the naughtiest Ben and Rooney were surprised you.
Always, yeah, especially Rooney, brilliantly. You know, I guess because something that was really important to Sarah and Miriam Taves, who wrote the novel, was that these women laughed, you know. There was like... people who kind of hurt the hardest laughed the loudest, and that... they use laughter and have laughter so much in their lives. And Rooney one day basically brought in a fart machine. And
oh, my God.
It was...
To the hayloft?
It doesn't seem like her vibe, a fart machine, I have to say. Oh, really? She has that?
Yeah. Rooney's so naughty. She's such a like little naughty twinkle. She's so twinkly. Don't be fooled. That's what happened to us. And then this kind of sound erupted and we were like, oh, my God. Who's that? You know, we were all looking around like sheepishly, and it was Rooney. She'd planted.
Wow, I would have never pegged her as like the prankster on set. What was your role on set? Like, who were you as far as like, I mean.
Miserable? No. I don't know. I liked it, you know, you keep it light and kind of until you have to go because It's too intense otherwise. It's too much.
So in 2022, Jessie starred in the horror film Men, in which she's affronted by these various ghosts of sort of toxic male archetypes, like a Me Too, a Christmas Carol. And in a way, the film sets up as an interesting juxtaposition against women talking, because Men feels like this very heavy dose of toxic masculinity, whereas Women Talking is pretty much all women on the screen all the time, and it was a totally women-led set. So it's interesting to talk to her about those two experiences back to back. On the lighter side, kind of, but equally as exhausting, she played Sally Bowles to great acclaim in Cabaret on London's West End, and she, I think, went into Cabaret the week after finishing filming Women Talking. So. Wow. By the end of this past year, I think she was just exhausted.
I'm exhausted hearing it.
I know.
At Christmas, I was like, whew, I feel like I've been hit by a train. If I'd had like one of those things, it would have been... But sometimes like there's just like a flow, you know, you're just like... And a lot of those projects, I always feel like these... Sometimes these things come in kind of pairs, or there's just something in the air, or there's certain stories that meet you at certain points in your life, and you kind of... You were all with it. And Cabaret was such an amazing experience.
Do you miss doing theater? Are you going to go back soon, you think?
I always miss doing theater, yeah. It's like the best feeling in the world to kind of... I started in the theater and kind of, you know, having that intimacy with audience. And in Cabaret, you know, we were in the round, so you could just see people's faces and see people's eyes. And every night you're terrified, and then you kind of get that rush. And like Sally was just such a kind of firecracker, you know, you just really, you got on that train at the beginning of the night and then you came off and you're like, I have no idea what just happened.
Wow. Wow.
But it was great. It was great to kind of be back and doing that again. Yeah.
What are you, and then you, I read that you trained with Fusetti, a clown master last summer. What inspired that?
I think a few years ago, a friend of mine told me to watch this film called La Strada by Fellini.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife, Giulietta Masina, is one of my favorite actresses. She's like this little punchy firecracker.
Yeah.
And it's just the most beautiful film. And I think clowning as an art form has kind of been forgotten in our world. Like before, it used to be integral to society and to kind of politics even, you know, like in King Lear, the fool was the person who kind of exposes the wounds within society. And it's all about failure and finding the beauty within failure, clowning. And it's unlike any kind of performance work that I've done, because it relies primarily on an audience. Like it's a three-way relationship, and these balls are constantly dropping, and the purpose of the clown is to catch the ball that's fallen and to find something beautiful with that and with the audience. And I loved it. Also, female clowns, like, you never see them. No. You know?
It's true. You don't think of a lot of female clowns.
And actually, I think like we wear makeup all the time, and we're just like on the cusp of basically looking like clowns sometimes. So I was like, let's go further with this.
Although there was no makeup on the set of, is it true that there was no makeup?
On Women Talking, I couldn't believe
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We all had no makeup. We all had hairy legs.
Wow.
Wow, yeah. Really lived it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
What about underarms?
Yeah, why not?
What are you reading, watching, listening to right now?
I read four great books when I was doing Fingernails.
Okay.
Both of Esther Perel's books.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Mating in Captivity and A State of Affairs, which was...
Which one should I read? Both? Neither?
It depends where you are in your life. What are you looking for? If you want basically to have an affair and it be okay, read State of Affairs.
I think I'll go with the other one.
But they're both brilliant. Actually, they're super interesting because it kind of blows the lid on the taboos of things like within relationships, right, which are still taboos, you know, right, and actually are so common in our kind of world. And then I read this book called Vladimir by Julia May Jonas, which is quite sexy. And then I read this amazing book, which blew my mind. and I've been giving it to all my girlfriends, called Cassandra Speaks by Elizabeth Lesser. And Fran McDormand told me about it, and I got it. Whenever I buy way too many books, I like, when somebody tells me to read a book, I'm like, bought it. And then like three kind of books arrive home that are like bad feminist hunger, like all these things. Fred, my partner, is like, chill, Jess. Really like chill Christmas read. But Cassandra Speaks is extraordinary. And it's about reclaiming, you know, the origin stories which we've always understood about ourselves as women. Hmm. And actually, are they ours in the first place? And actually, how we actually now is our time to make our own origin stories.
Well, that's sort of lost daughter and women talking.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Jessie, thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you for coming. This is so great.
Thanks for having me.
Love Jessie. Want to go shopping with Jessie?
I know, totally. Yeah, I want to have Jessie make me one of her t-shirts.
I know.
That's the real get. And frankly, what I actually want is to be in Jessie and Frances McDormand's book club. Oh, my God. I mean, talk about women talking. That's the dream.
This is the outro, right?
The thing that says outro, yeah.
Sorry. The Run For It Vogue is a production of Condé Nast Entertainment. Make sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like the show, please rate and review it.
We want to hear from you. Send us a hello or any questions, thoughts, anything about the show to therunthroughatvogue.com.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel. Bye.
Bye.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.